Not at close range, possibly point blank. There are burn marks around the entry wound. We're guessing that he was shot first. He was thrown against the dining table. The gunman could have stood in the hall or just inside the doorway to the living room. According to witnesses, people who live on the same staircase, the shots were fired within a few seconds of each other. Mia Johansson was shot from a greater distance. She was probably standing in the entrance to the bedroom and tried to turn away. The bullet hit her below the left ear and exited just above the right eye. The impact threw her into the bedroom where she was found. She hit the foot of the bed and slid to the floor. "A single shot fired by someone used to handling guns," Fastia said. More than that, there were no footprints to indicate that the killer went into the bedroom to check that she was dead. He knew he had hit his mark and he left the apartment. So two shots, two bodies, and then out. We'll have to wait for forensics, but I'm guessing that the killer used hunting ammunition. Death would have been instantaneous. There were ghastly wounds in both victims. The team considered this summary in silence. It was a debate that none of them needed to be reminded of. There are two types of ammunition. Hard, full-metal jacketed bullets that go straight through the body and cause comparatively modest damage. And soft ammunition that expands in the body on impact and does enormous damage. There is a vast difference between hitting a person with a bullet that's 9 millimeters in diameter and a bullet that expands to a couple of centimeters or more in diameter. The latter type is called hunting ammunition, and its objective is to cause massive bleeding. It is considered more humane when hunting moose, since the aim is to put down the prey as quickly and painlessly as possible. But hunting ammunition is forbidden for use in war by international law because a soldier hit by an expanding bullet almost always dies, no matter where the point of entry. In its wisdom, however, the Swedish police had introduced hollow-body hunting ammunition to the police arsenal 2 years earlier. Exactly why was unclear, but it was quite clear that if, for example, the demonstrator Hannes Westberg, who was hit in the stomach during the World Trade Organization riots in Göteborg in 2001, had been shot with hunting ammo, he would not have survived.
"So the purpose unquestionably was to kill," Anderson said.
He was speaking of the murders in Enschede, but he was also voicing his opinion in the silent debate going on around the table. Nyberg and Mortensen agreed.
"Then we have this improbable time frame," Poblansky said.
"Exactly. Immediately after the fatal shots were fired, the killer leaves the apartment, goes down the stairs, drops the weapon, and vanishes into the night. Shortly thereafter, it can only have been a matter of seconds, Blomqvist and his sister drive up and park outside. One possibility is that the killer left through the basement. There's a side entrance he could have used, into the back courtyard and across a lawn to the street that runs parallel. But he would have had to have a key to the basement door."
"Is there any sign at all that the killer left that way?"
"No."
"So, no description to go on," Modig said. "But why did he ditch the weapon? If he had taken it with him, or if he had flung it away some distance from the building, we wouldn't have found it for a while."
It was a question that no one could answer.
"What should we think about Blomqvist?" Fastia said.
"No question he was in shock," Mortensen said. "But he acted sensibly. He seemed clear-headed, and I thought he was trustworthy. His sister, a lawyer, confirmed the phone call and the drive there by car. I don't think he was involved."
"He's a celebrity journalist," Modig said.
"So this is going to turn into a media circus," Poblansky said. "All the more reason to wrap it up as fast as we can."
"Okay.
Jekka, you deal with the crime scene, of course, and the neighbours. Fusty, you and Kurt investigate the victims. Who were they? What were they working on? Who was in their circle of friends? Who might have had a motive to kill them? Sonia, you and I will go over the witness statements from that night. Then you'll make a schedule of what Svensson and Johansson were doing all day yesterday before they were killed. We'll meet here at 2 this afternoon."
Blomqvist began his working day at Svensson's desk. He sat quite still for a long while, as if he did not feel up to taking on the task. Svensson had his own laptop and had initially worked mostly from home. He had usually spent 2 days a week in the office, more in the last weeks. At Millennium he had access to an older Power Mac G3, a computer that lived on his desk and could be used by any of the staff. Blomqvist turned on the G3 and found much of the material Svensson had been working on. He had primarily used the G3 to search the net, but there were various folders that he had copied over from his laptop. He also had a complete backup on 2 disks that he kept locked in the desk drawer.
Usually he had backed up new and updated material every day, but since he had not been in the office for a few days, the latest copy was from Sunday night. 3 days were missing. Blomqvist made a copy of the zip disk and locked it in the safe in his office. Then he spent 45 minutes going through the contents of the original disk. It contained around 30 folders and countless subfolders. 4 years of Svensson's research on trafficking. He read the document names and looked for ones that might contain the most sensitive material, the names of sources that Svensson was protecting. He had clearly been very careful with his sources. All such material was in a folder labelled Sources_Confidential. The folder contained 134 documents, most of them quite small. Blomqvist highlighted all the documents and deleted them. He dragged them to an icon for the burn program, which did not simply delete the documents, but eradicated them byte by byte. Then he tackled Svensson's email. He had been given his own email address at Millennium, which he used both at the office and on his laptop. He had his own password, but that did not present a problem, since Blomqvist had administrator rights and was able to access the entire mail server. He downloaded a copy of Svensson's email and burned it to a CD. Finally, he turned his attention to the mountain of paper made up of reference material, notes, press clippings, court judgments, and all the correspondence that Svensson had accumulated. He played it safe and made copies of everything that looked important. That came to 2,000 pages and took him 3 hours. He set to one side all the material that might in any way be connected to a confidential source. It was a stack of about 40 pages, mainly notes from 2 A4 pads that Svensson had locked in his desk. Blomqvist put this material in an envelope and took it into his office. Then he carried all the other material that was part of Svensson's project to his desk. When he was finished, he took a deep breath and went down to the 7-Eleven, where he had a coffee and a slice of pizza. He mistakenly assumed that the police would arrive at any moment to go through Svensson's desk. Boblansky had an unexpected breakthrough in the investigation just after 10 a.m., when he was called by Lennart Granlund of the National Forensics Laboratory in Linköping.
"It's about the killings at Enschede."
"So soon?"
"We received the weapon early this morning, and I'm not quite done with the analysis, but I have some information that might interest you."
"Good. Tell me what you've come up with," Boblansky said.
"The weapon is a Colt 45 Magnum, made in the USA in 1981. We have fingerprints and possible DNA, but that analysis will take a little time. We've also looked at the bullets that the couple were shot with. Not surprisingly, they appear to have been fired from that weapon. That's usually the case when we find a gun in the stairwell at a crime scene. The bullets are badly fragmented, but we have a piece to use for comparison. It's most likely that this is the murder weapon."
"An illegal weapon, I suppose."
"Do you have a serial number?" "The weapon is quite legal. It belongs to a lawyer, Niels Erik Björman, and was bought in 1983. He's a member of the police shooting club. He lives on Upplandsgarten near Odenplan."
"What on earth are you saying?"
"We also found, as I mentioned, a number of prints on the weapon. Prints from at least 2 different people. We may expect that one set belongs to Björman, insofar as the weapon was not reported stolen or sold. But I have no information on that."
"Aha. In other words, we have a lead."
"We have a hit in the register for the second set. Prints from the right thumb and forefinger."
"Who is it?"
"A woman, born on April 30th, 1978. Arrested for an assault in Gamlestan in 1995 when the prints were taken."
"Does she have a name?"
"Yes. Her name is Lisbeth Salander."
Boblansky wrote down the name and a social security number that Granlund gave him. When Blomqvist returned to work after his late lunch, he went straight to his office and closed the door, making it clear that he did not want to be disturbed. He had not had time to deal with all the peripheral information in Svensson's email and notes. He would have to settle down and read through the book and the articles with completely new eyes, keeping in mind now that the author was dead and unable to answer any difficult questions that might need to be asked. He had to decide whether the book could still be published. And he had to make up his mind whether there was anything in the material that might hint at a motive for murder. He switched on his computer and set to work. Boblansky made a brief call to Ekström to tell him what had developed at NFL. It was decided that Boblansky and Murdig would pay a call on Advocate Bureman. It could be for a talk, an interrogation, or even an arrest. Faste and Anderson would track down this Lisbeth Salander and ask her to explain how her fingerprints came to be on a murder weapon. The search for Bjurman at first presented no difficulty. His address was listed in the tax records, the weapons registry, and the vehicle licensing database. It was even in the telephone book. Boblansky and Murdig drove to Odenplan and managed to get into the building on Oplandsgarten when a young man came out just as they arrived. After that, it was trickier. When they rang Bjurman's doorbell, no one answered. They drove to his office at St. Eriksplan, but got the same result there.
"Maybe he's in court," Murdig said.
"Maybe he got on a plane to Brazil after shooting two people in Enschede," Boblansky said.
Murdig glanced at her colleague. She enjoyed his company. She would not have had anything against flirting with him, but for the fact that she was a mother of two, and she and Boblansky were both happily married. From the brass nameplates on Bjurman's floor, they noted that his nearest neighbours were a dentist, Dr. Norman, a company called N. Consulting, and Rune Håkansson, a lawyer. They started with Håkansson.
"Hello, my name is Murdig, and this is Inspector Boblansky. We're from the police and have business with Nils-Erik Bjurman, your colleague from next door. Do you know where we might find him?"
Håkansson shook his head.
"I haven't seen much of him lately. He was seriously ill 2 years ago and has more or less shut down his practice. I only see him about once every 2 months."
"Seriously ill?" Boblansky said.
"I'm not sure what with. He was always working flat out, and then he was taken ill. Cancer, I assumed. I hardly know him."
"Do you think, or do you know, that he got cancer?" Murdig said.
"Well, no, I'm not sure. He had a secretary, Britt Carlson, or Nielsen, something like that, an older woman. He let her go, and she was the one who told me that he was ill. That was in the spring of 2003. I didn't see him again until December of that year. He looked 10 years older, gaunt and grey-haired. I drew my own conclusions."
They went back to the apartment. Still no answer. Boblansky took out his mobile and dialed Bjurman's mobile number. He got an automated message. "The subscriber you are calling cannot be reached at present. Please try again later." He tried the number at the apartment. On the landing they could hear a faint ringing from the other side of the door before an answering machine clicked on and asked the caller to leave a message. It was 1 p.m.
"Coffee?"
"I need a burger."
At Burger King on Odenplan, Murdig had a Whopper and Boblansky a veggie burger. Then they returned to police headquarters. Prosecutor Ekstrom called the meeting to order at the conference table in his office at 2. Boblansky and Murdig took seats next to each other by the wall near the window. Anderson arrived 2 minutes later and sat down opposite them. Holmberg came in with a tray of coffee in paper cups. He had paid a brief visit to Enschede and intended to return later in the afternoon when the texts were finished.
"Where's Fasti?" Ekstrom asked.
"He's with the Social Welfare Agency. He called 5 minutes ago and said he'd be a little late," Svensson said.
"We'll get started anyway. What have we got?"
Ekstrom began without ceremony. He pointed first to Boblansky.
"We've been looking for Niels Bjurman, the registered owner of what is probably the murder weapon. He isn't at home or at his office. According to another lawyer in the same building, he fell ill 2 years ago, and has more or less shut down his practice."
Murdig said, "Bjurman is 55, not listed in the criminal register. He's mainly a business lawyer. I haven't had time to research his background beyond that."
"But he does own the gun that was used in Enschede."
"That's correct. He has a license for it, and he's a member of the police shooting club," Boblansky said. "I talked to Gunnarsson in weapons. He's the chairman of the club and knows Bjurman well. He joined in 1978 and was treasurer from 1984 to 1992. Gunnarsson describes Bjurman as an excellent shot with a pistol, calm and collected and no funny stuff."
"A gun freak?"
"Gunnarsson thinks Bjurman was more interested in club life than in the shooting itself. He liked to compete, but he didn't stand out, at least not as a gun fanatic. In 1983 he participated in the Swedish championships and came in 13th. For the past 10 years he's cut back on shooting practice, and just shows up for annual meetings and such."
"Does he own any other weapons?"
"He has had licenses for 4-hand guns since he joined the shooting club. In addition to the Colt, he's had a Beretta, a Smith & Wesson, and a competition pistol made by Rapid. The other three were sold within the club 10 years ago, and the licenses were transferred to other members."
"And we have no idea where he is?"
"That's correct. But we've only been looking for him since 10 this morning. He may be out walking in Djurgården, or in hospital, or whatever."
At that moment Fasti burst in. He seemed out of breath.
"Sorry I'm late. May I jump right in?"
Ekstrom motioned. "Be my guest."
"Elizabeth Salander is a very interesting character. I've spent the morning at the Social Welfare Agency and the Guardianship Agency."
He took off his leather jacket and hung it over the back of his chair before he sat down and opened a notebook.
"The Guardianship Agency?" Ekstrom said with a frown. "This is one very disturbed lady," Fasti said. "She was declared incompetent and put under guardianship."
"Guess who's her guardian?" He paused for effect.
"Niels Bjørman, the owner of the weapon that was used in Enschede."
This announcement certainly had the effect Fasti had anticipated. It took him 15 more minutes to brief the group on all he had learned about Salander.
"To sum up," Ekstrom said when Fasti was finished, "we have fingerprints on the probable murder weapon from a woman who, during her teens, was in and out of psychiatric units, who is understood to make her living as a prostitute, who was declared incompetent by the district court, and who has been documented as having violent tendencies. We shall be asking what the hell she's doing out on the streets at all."
"She's had violent tendencies since she was in elementary school," said Fasti. "She seems to be a real psycho."
"But so far we have nothing to link her to the couple in Enschede."
Ekstrom drummed his fingertips on the tabletop.
"This double murder may not be so hard to solve after all. Have we got an address for Salander?"
"On Lundegarten in Södermalm.
Tax records show that she declared periodic income from Milton Security." "And what in God's name was she doing for them?"
"I don't know. It's a pretty modest annual income for several years. Maybe she's a cleaning woman or something."
"Hmm," Ekstrom said. "We'll have that checked out. Right now we have to find her."
"We'll have to work out the details gradually," Boblansky said. "But now we have a suspect. Hans, you and Kurt go down to Lundegarten and pick up Salander. Be careful. We don't know if she has any other weapons, and we don't really know how dangerous she may be."
"Okay."
"Babel," Ekstrom said, "the head of Milton Security is Dragan Armansky. I met him on a case a few years ago. He's reliable. Go to his office and have a private talk with him about Salander. You'd better get there before he leaves for the day."
Boblansky was visibly annoyed, partly because Ekstrom had used his nickname, partly because he had formulated his request as an order.
"Budig," Boblansky said, "keep looking for Bjørman. Knock on all the neighbors' doors. I think it's just as important to find him."
"Okay."
"We have to find the connection between Salander and the couple in Enschede. And we have to place Salander down in Enschede at the time of the murders. Yerka, get some pictures of her and check with everyone who lives in the same apartment building. Knock on doors this evening. Get some uniforms to help you out."
Boblansky paused and scratched the back of his neck.
"Damn. With a little luck we could tie up this mess tonight. I thought this was going to be a long, drawn-out affair."
"One more thing," Ekstrom said. "The media are obviously pressuring us. I promised them a press conference at 3 p.m. I can handle it, provided I get somebody from the press office to help out. I'm guessing that a number of journalists will call you directly as well. We'll say nothing at all about Salander and Bjørman for as long as need be."
Armansky had considered going home early. It was Maundy Thursday, and he and his wife had planned to go to their summer cabin on Blidö over the Easter weekend. He had just closed his briefcase and put on his coat when the receptionist buzzed him and said that Criminal Inspector Jan Boblansky was looking for him. Armansky did not know Boblansky, but the fact that a senior police officer had come to the office was enough to make him hang his coat back on the coat rack. He did not feel like seeing anyone at all, but Milton Security could not afford to ignore the police. He met Boblansky by the elevator in the corridor.
"Thanks for taking the time to see me," Boblansky said. "My boss sends his greetings. Prosecutor Ekstrom."
They shook hands.
"Ekstrom. I've had dealings with him a few times. It's been several years. Would you like some coffee?"
Armansky stopped at the coffee machine and pressed the buttons for 2 cups before he invited Boblansky into his office and offered him the comfortable chair by the window.
"Armansky. Russian," Boblansky said. "My name ends in ski, too. My family comes from Armenia. And yours?" "Poland."
"How can I help you?"
Boblansky took out his notebook.
"I'm investigating the killings in Enschede. I assume you heard the news today."
Armansky gave a brisk nod.
"Ekstrom said that you're discreet."
"In my position it pays to cooperate with the police.
I can keep a secret, if that's what you're wondering.
Good. We're looking for an individual who worked for your company at one time. Lisbeth Salander. Do you know her?
Armansky felt a lump of cement form in his stomach. His expression did not change.
And why are you looking for Fröken Salander?
Let's just say we have reason to consider her a person of interest in the investigation.
The lump of cement in Armansky's stomach expanded. It almost caused him physical pain. Since the day he'd first met Salander, he had had a strong presentiment that her life was on a trajectory towards catastrophe, but he had always imagined her as a victim, not an offender. He still showed no emotion.
So you suspect Lisbeth Salander of the killings in Enschede? Do I understand you correctly?
Poblansky hesitated a moment, and then he nodded.
What can you tell me about her?
What do you want to know?
First of all, how can we find her?
She lives on Lundagarten. I'll have to look up the exact address. I have a mobile telephone number for her.
We have the address. The mobile number will be helpful.
Armansky went to his desk and read out the number, which Poblansky wrote down.
She works for you. She has her own business. I gave her freelance assignments now and then from 1998 until about a year and a half ago. What sort of jobs did she do?
Research.
Poblansky looked up from his notebook.
Research?
He said.
Personal investigations, to be more precise.
Just a moment. Are we talking about the same girl? Lisbeth Salander, we're looking for, didn't finish school, and was officially declared incompetent to manage her affairs.
They don't say incompetent nowadays, Armansky said calmly.
I don't give a damn what they say nowadays. The girl we're looking for has a record which says she is a deeply disturbed and violence-prone individual. It says in her social welfare agency file that she was a prostitute in the late 90s. There is nothing anywhere in her records to indicate that she could hold down a white-collar job. Files are one thing. People are something else.
You mean that she is qualified to do personal investigations for Milton Security?
Not only that. She is by far the best researcher I've ever had.
Poblansky put down his pen and frowned.
It sounds as though you have respect for her.
Armansky looked at his hands. The question marked a fork in the road. He had always feared that Salander would end up in hot water sooner or later, but he could not conceive of her being mixed up in a double murder in Enschede, as the killer or in any other way. But what did he know about her private life? Armansky thought of her recent visit to his office, in which she had cryptically explained that she had enough money to get by and did not need a job. The wisest thing to do at that moment would be to distance himself, and above all, Milton Security, from all contact with Salander. But then Salander was probably the loneliest person he knew.
I have respect for her skills. You won't find that in her school results or personal record. So you know about her background. The fact that she's under guardianship, and that she had a pretty confused upbringing, yes. And yet you trusted her.
That is precisely why I trusted her.
Please explain.
Her previous guardian, Holger Palmgren, was old J.F. Milton's lawyer. He took on her case when she was a teenager, and he persuaded me to give her a job. I employed her initially to sort the mail and look after the photocopier, things like that. But she turned out to have unbelievable talents. And you can forget any report that says she may have been a prostitute. That's nonsense. Lisbeth had a difficult period in her teens and was undoubtedly a bit wild, but that's not the same as breaking the law. Prostitution is probably the last thing in the world she would turn to.
Her current guardian is a lawyer by the name of Nils Bjurman.
I've never met him. Palmgren had a cerebral hemorrhage a couple of years ago. Lisbeth cut back on the work she did for me quite soon after that happened. The last job she did was in October a year and a half ago.
Why did you stop employing her?
It wasn't my choice. She was the one who broke off contact and disappeared abroad, without a word of explanation.
Disappeared abroad?
She was gone for about a year.
That can't be right. Bjurman sent in monthly reports on her for all of last year. We have copies up at Kungsholmen.
Admansky shrugged and smiled.
When was the last time you saw her?
In early February. She popped up out of nowhere and paid me a social visit. She spent all of last year out of the country, travelling in Asia and the Caribbean.
Forgive me, but I'm getting a little muddled here. I had the impression that this Elizabeth Salander was a mentally ill girl who hadn't even finished school and who was under guardianship. Now you tell me that you trusted her as an exceptional researcher, that she has her own business, and that she earned enough money to take a year off and travel around the world, all without her guardian sounding the alarm. Something doesn't add up here.
There's quite a bit that doesn't add up regarding Fröken Salander.
May I ask, what is your overall opinion of her?
Armansky thought for a while. Finally he said,
She's one of the most irritating, inflexible people I've met in my whole life.
Inflexible? She won't do anything she doesn't want to do. She doesn't give a damn what other people think of her. She is tremendously skilled, and she is unlike anyone I've ever met.
Is she unbalanced?
How do you define unbalanced?
Is she capable of murdering two people in cold blood?
Armansky was quiet for a long time.
I'm sorry. I can't answer that question. I'm a cynic. I believe that everyone has it in them to kill another person, in desperation or hatred, or at least to defend themselves.
You don't discount the possibility, at any rate.
Elizabeth Salander will not do anything unless she has a good reason for it.
If she murdered someone, then she must have felt that she had a very good reason to do so. On what grounds do you suspect her of being involved in these murders?
Boblansky met Armansky's gaze.
Can we keep this confidential?
Absolutely.
The murder weapon belonged to her guardian, and her fingerprints were on it.
Armansky clenched his teeth. That was serious circumstantial evidence.
I've only heard about the murders on the radio. What was it about? Drugs? Is she mixed up with drugs?
Not that I know of. But as I said, she went through a bad time in her teens, and she was arrested a few times for being drunk. Her record will tell you whether drugs were involved.
We don't have a motive for the murders. They were a conscientious couple. She was a criminologist and was just about to get her doctorate. He was a journalist. Dag Svensson and Mia Johansson. Do those names ring any bells?
Armansky shook his head.
We are trying to find a connection between them and Lisbeth Salander. I've never heard of them.
Boblansky stood up.
Thanks for your time. It's been a fascinating conversation. I don't know how much the wiser I am for it, but I hope we can keep all of this between ourselves.
Of course.
I'll get back to you if necessary. And of course, if Salander should get in touch...
Certainly,
Armansky said. They shook hands. Boblansky was on his way out the door when he stopped.
You don't happen to know anyone that Salander associates with, do you? Friends? Acquaintances?
Armansky shook his head.
I don't know a single thing about her private life, except that her old guardian meant something to her. Olga Palmgren. He's in a nursing home in Ersta. She might have made contact with him since she came back.
She never had visitors when she was working here. Would there be a record of that?
No. She worked from home mainly and came in only to present her reports. With a few exceptions, she never even met the clients.
Possibly.
Armansky was struck by a thought.
What? There is just possibly one other person she may have got in touch with. A journalist she knew a couple of years ago. He was looking for her when she was out of the country.
A journalist?
His name is Mikael Blomqvist. Do you remember the Wennerström affair?
Boblansky came slowly back into Armansky's office.
It was Blomqvist who discovered the couple in Enschede. You've just established a link between Salander and the murder victims.
Armansky again felt the solid pain of the lump in his stomach. Chapter 14. Maundy Thursday, March 24th. Murdig tried three times in half an hour to reach Niels Spearman on his mobile. each time she got the message that the subscriber could not be reached. At 3:30 p.m. she drove to Odenplan and rang his doorbell. Once more, no answer. She spent the next 20 minutes knocking on doors in the apartment building to see if any of Bjorman's neighbours knew where he might be. In 11 of the 19 apartments, no one was there. It was obviously the wrong time of day to be knocking on doors, and it would not get any better over the Easter weekend. In the 8 apartments that were occupied, everyone was helpful. 5 of them knew who Bjorman was, a polite, well-mannered gentleman on the 5th floor. No one could provide any information as to his whereabouts. She managed to ascertain that Bjorman might be visiting one of his closest neighbours, a businessman named Sjurman. But nobody answered the door there, either. Frustrated, Murdig took out her mobile and called Bjorman's answering machine once again. She gave her name, left her number, and asked him to please contact her as soon as he could. She went back to Bjorman's door and wrote him a note asking him to call her. She got out a business card and dropped that through the mail slot as well. Just as she closed the flap, she heard a telephone ring inside the apartment. She leaned down and listened intently as it rang 4 times. She heard the answering machine click on, but she could not hear any message. She closed the flap on the mail slot and stared at the door. Exactly what impulse made her reach out and touch the handle, she could not have said. But to her great surprise, the door was unlocked. She pushed it open and peered into the hall. "Hello?" she called cautiously, and listened. There was no sound. She took a step into the hall and then hesitated. She had no warrant to search the premises and no right to be in the apartment, even if the door was unlocked. She looked to her left and got a glimpse of the living room. She had just decided to back out of the apartment when her glance fell on the hall table. She saw a box for a Colt Magnum pistol. Murdig suddenly had a strong sense of unease. She opened her jacket and drew her service weapon, which she had rarely done before. She clicked off the safety catch and aimed the gun at the floor as she went to the living room and looked in. She saw nothing untoward, but her apprehension increased. She backed out and peered into the kitchen. Empty. She went down the corridor and pushed open the bedroom door. Bjorman's naked body lay half-stretched out on the bed. His knees were on the floor. It was as though he had knelt to say his prayers. Even from the door, Murdig could tell that he was dead. Half of his forehead had been blown away by a shot to the back of his head. Murdig closed the apartment door behind her. She still had her service revolver in her hand as she flipped open her mobile and called Inspector Bublansky. She could not reach him. Next, she called Prosecutor Ekström. She made a note of the time. It was 4:18. Foster looked at the entrance door to the building on Lundegarten. He looked at Anderson, and then at his watch. 4:10. After obtaining the entry code from the caretaker, they had already been inside the building and listened at the door with the nameplate Salander Wu. They had heard no sound from the apartment, and nobody had answered the bell. They returned to their car and parked where they could keep watch on the door. From the car they had ascertained by phone that the person in Stockholm whose name had been recently added to the contract for the apartment on Lundegarten was Miriam Wu, born in 1974 and previously living at St. Eriksplan. They had a passport photograph of Salander taped above the car radio. Foster muttered out loud that she looked like a bitch.
"Shit, the whores are looking worse all the time. You'd have to be pretty desperate to pick her up."
Anderson kept his mouth shut. At 4:20 they were called by Bublansky, who told them he was on his way from Armansky's to the Millennium offices. He asked Fasti and Anderson to maintain their watch at Lundegarten. Salander would have to be brought in for questioning, but they should be aware that the prosecutor did not think she could be linked to the killings in Enschede.
"All right," Fasti said. "According to Bubble, the prosecutor wants to have a confession before they arrest anybody."
Anderson said nothing. Listlessly they watched people moving through the neighbourhood. At 4:40, Prosecutor Ekström called Fasti's mobile.
"Things are happening. We found Bjorman shot in his apartment. He's been dead for at least 24 hours.
Fasti sat up in his seat.
"Got it. What should we do?"
"I'm going to issue an alert on Salander. She's being sought as a suspect in 3 murders. We'll send it out county-wide. We have to consider her dangerous and very possibly armed."
"Got it."
"I'm sending a van to Lundegarten. They'll go in and secure the apartment."
"Understood."
"Have you been in touch with Bublansky?" He's at Millennium, and seems to have turned off his phone. Could you try to reach him and let him know? Fusty and Anderson looked at each other.
The question is, what do we do if she turns up?
Anderson said.
If she's alone and things look good, we'll pick her up. This girl is as crazy as hell and obviously on a killing spree. There may be more weapons in the apartment.
Blomqvist was dead tired when he laid the pile of manuscript pages on Berger's desk and slumped into the chair by the window overlooking Goethegarten. He had spent the whole afternoon trying to make up his mind what they ought to do with Svensson's unfinished book. Svensson had been dead only a few hours, and already his publisher was debating what to do with the work he had left behind. An outsider might think it cynical and cold-hearted, but Blomqvist did not see it that way. He felt as if he were in an almost weightless state. It was a sensation that every reporter or newspaper editor knew well, and it kicked in at moments of direst crisis. When other people are grieving, the newspaper man turns efficient. And despite the numbing shock that afflicted the members of the Millennium team who were there that Maundy Thursday morning, professionalism took over and was rigorously channeled into work. For Blomqvist, this went without saying. He and Svensson were two of a kind, and Svensson would have done the same himself if their roles had been reversed. He would have asked himself what he could do for Blomqvist. Svensson had left a legacy in the form of a manuscript with an explosive story. He had worked on it for 4 years. He had put his soul into a task which he would now never complete. And he had chosen to work at Millennium. The murders of Dag Svensson and Mia Johansson were not a national trauma on the scale of the murder of Olof Palme, and the investigation would not be minutely followed by a grieving nation. But for employees of Millennium, the shock was perhaps greater. They were affected personally, and Svensson had a broad network of contacts in the media who were going to demand answers to their questions. But now it was Blomqvist's and Berger's duty to finish Svensson's book, and to answer the questions, who killed them, and why.
"I can reconstruct the unfinished text," Blomqvist said. "Marlin and I have to go through the unedited chapters line by line and see where more work still needs to be done. For most of it, all we have to do is follow Dag's notes. But we do have a problem in chapters 4 and 5, which are largely based on Mia's interviews. Dag didn't fill in who the sources were, but with one or two exceptions, I think we can use the references in her thesis as a primary source."
"What about the last chapter?"
"I have Dag's outline, and we talked it through so many times that I know more or less exactly what he wanted to say. I propose that we lift the summary and use it as an afterword, where I can also explain his reasoning."
"Fair enough. But I want to approve it. We can't be putting words in his mouth."
"No danger of that. I'll write the chapter as my personal reflection and sign it. I'll describe how he came to write and research the book and say what sort of person he was. I'll conclude by recapping what he said in at least a dozen conversations over the past few months. There's plenty in his draft that I can quote. I think I can make it sound dignified."
"I want this book published more than ever," Berger said.
Blomqvist understood exactly what she meant.
Berger put her reading glasses on the desk and shook her head. She got up and poured 2 cups of coffee from the thermos and sat down opposite Blomqvist. "Krista and I have a layout for the replacement issue. We've taken 2 articles earmarked for the issue after this one, and we're going to fill the gaps with freelance material, but it'll be a bit of this and a bit of that. An issue without any real focus."
They sat quietly for a moment.
"Have you listened to the news?" Berger asked.
"No. I know what they're going to say."
"It's the top story on every radio station. The second-place story is a political move by the Centre Party."
"Which means that absolutely nothing else is happening in the country."
"The police haven't released their names yet. They're being described as a conscientious couple. No one's mentioned that it was you who found them."
"I'll bet the police will do all they can to keep it quiet. At least that's to our advantage."
"Why would the police want to do that?"
"Because detectives basically hate a media circus. I will guess something will leak out sometime tonight or early tomorrow morning."
"So young and so cynical."
"We aren't that young anymore, Ricky. I thought about it while I was being questioned last night. The police inspector looked like she could still be at school."
Berger gave a weak laugh. She had had a few hours' sleep last night, but she was beginning to feel the strain. Still, in no time at all, she would be editor-in-chief of one of the largest newspapers in Sweden. And no,
This was not the right time to reveal that news to Blomqvist.
Henry called a while ago. A preliminary investigation leader named Ekström held some sort of press conference this afternoon.
Richard Ekström?
Yes. Do you know him?
Political flunky. Guaranteed media circus. This is going to get plenty of publicity.
Well, he says that the police are already following up certain leads and hope to solve the case soon. Otherwise, he pretty much said nothing. But apparently the place was jammed with reporters.
Blomqvist rubbed his eyes.
I can't get the image of Mia's body out of my mind. Damn. I was just getting to know them.
Some crazy...
I don't know. I've been thinking about it all day.
About what?
Mia was shot from the side. I saw the entry wound on the side of her neck and the exit wound in her forehead. Dag was shot from the front. The bullet went into his forehead and came out the back of his head. Those looked to be the only two shots. It doesn't feel like the act of a lone nutcase.
Berger looked at her partner thoughtfully.
So what was it?
If it's not a random killing, then there has to be a motive. And the more I think about it, the more it feels as if this manuscript provides a damned good motive.
Blomqvist gestured at the stack of paper on Berger's desk. She followed his eyes. Then they looked at each other.
Maybe it's not the book itself. Maybe they'd done too much snooping and managed to... I don't know. Maybe somebody felt threatened
and hired a hitman. Mika, that's the stuff of American movies. This book is about the exploiters, the users. It names police officers, politicians, journalists. So you think one of them murdered Dag and Mia?
I don't know, Ricky. But we're supposed to be going to press in 3 weeks with the toughest exposé of trafficking that's ever been published in Sweden.
At that moment, Ericsson knocked and put her head round the door. And Inspector Bublansky wanted to speak with Blomqvist. Bublansky shook hands with Berger and Blomqvist and sat down in the third chair at the table by the window. He studied Blomqvist and saw a hollow-eyed man with a day's growth of beard.
"Have there been any developments?" Blomqvist said. "Maybe. I understand you were the one who found the couple in Enschede and called the police last night."
Blomqvist nodded wearily.
"I know that you told your story to the detective on duty last night, but I wonder if you could clarify a few details for me."
"What would you like to know?"
"How did you come to be driving over to see Svensson and Johansson so late at night?"
"That's not a detail. It's a whole novel," Blomqvist said with a tired smile. "I was at a dinner party at my sister's house. She lives in a new development in Stekkerd. Dag Svensson called me on my mobile and said that he wasn't going to have time to come to the office on Thursday. Today, that is, as we had previously agreed. He was supposed to deliver some photographs to our art director. And the reason he gave was that he and Mia had decided to drive up to her parents' house over the weekend, and they wanted to leave early in the morning. He asked if it would be okay if he messengered them to me last night instead. I said that since I lived so close, I could pick up the photographs on my way home from my sister's."
"So you drove to Enschede to pick up photographs?"
"Yes."
"Can you think of any motive for the murders of Svensson and Johansson?"
Blomqvist and Berger glanced at each other. Neither said a word.
"What is it?"
Bublansky wanted to know.
"We've discussed the matter today, and we're having a bit of a disagreement."
"Well, actually not a disagreement. We're just not certain. We would rather not speculate." "Tell me."
Blomqvist described to him the subject of Svensson's book, and how he and Berger had been discussing whether it might have some connection to the murders. Bublansky sat quietly for a moment, digesting the information.
"So, Dag Svensson was about to expose police officers."
He did not at all like the turn the conversation had taken, and imagined how a police trail might wander back and forth in the media and give rise to all kinds of conspiracy theories.
"No," Blomqvist said. "He was about to expose criminals, a few of whom happened to be police officers. There are also one or two members of my own profession, namely journalists."
"And you're thinking of publishing this information now?"
Blomqvist turned to look at Berger.
"No," she said. "We spent the day working on the next issue.
In all probability, we'll publish Svensson's book, but that won't happen until we know exactly what's going on. In light of what has happened, the book will have to be extensively reworked. We will do nothing to sabotage the investigation into the murder of our two friends, if that's what you're worried about.
I'll have to take a look at Svensson's desk, but since these are the editorial offices of a magazine, it might be a sensitive thing to put in hand a complete search.
You'll find all Dyke's material in his laptop, Berger said.
I've gone through his desk, Blomqvist said. I've taken some documents that directly identify sources who want to remain anonymous. You are at liberty to examine everything else, and I have put a note on the desk to the effect that nothing may be touched or moved. The problem is that the contents of the book absolutely have to remain under wraps until it's printed. We badly need to avoid having the text passed around the police force, the more so since we're going to hang one or two policemen out to dry.
Shit, Bublansky thought. Why didn't I come straight here this morning?
But he only nodded and changed tack.
Okay, we have a person we want to question in connection with the murders. I believe it's someone you know. I'd like to hear what you have to say about a woman named Lisbeth Salander.
For a second, Blomqvist looked like a virtual question mark, but Blansky noted that Berger gave her colleague a sharp look.
Now I don't understand. You know Lisbeth Salander?
Yes, I do know her.
How do you know her?
Why do you ask? Bublansky was obviously irritated, but all he said was,
I'd like to interview her in connection with the murders. How do you know her?
But that doesn't make sense. Lisbeth Salander has no connection whatsoever to Dag Svensson or Mia Johansson.
That's something we'll establish in due course, Bublansky said patiently. But my question remains, how do you know Lisbeth Salander?
Blomqvist stroked the stubble on his chin and then rubbed his eyes, as thoughts tumbled around in his head. At last he met Bublansky's gaze.
I hired her about 2 years ago to do some research for me on a completely different project.
What was that project?
I'm sorry, but now you'll have to take my word for it. It didn't have the slightest thing to do with Dag Svensson or Mia Johansson, and it's all over.
Bublansky did not like it when someone claimed there were matters that could not be discussed even in a murder investigation, but he chose to drop it for the time being.
When was the last time you saw Salander?
Blomqvist paused before he spoke.
Here's how it is. During the autumn, 2 years ago, I was seeing her. The relationship ended around Christmas of that year. Then she disappeared from the city. I hadn't seen her for more than a year until a week ago.
Berger raised her eyebrows. Bublansky surmised that this was news to her.
Tell me where you saw her.
Blomqvist took a deep breath and then gave a brisk account of the events on Lundegarten. Bublansky listened with gathering astonishment, unsure how much of the story Blomqvist was making up.
So you didn't talk to her?
No. She disappeared on Upper Lundegarten. I waited a long time, but she never came back. I wrote her a note and asked her to get in touch with me.
And you're quite sure you know of no connection between her and the couple in Enschede?
I am certain of it.
Can you describe the man you say you saw attack her?
Not in detail.
He attacked, and she defended herself and fled.
I saw him from a distance of 40 to 45 yards. It was late at night and quite dark.
Were you intoxicated?
I was a little under the influence, but I wasn't falling down drunk. The man had lightish hair in a ponytail. He wore a dark, waist-length jacket. He had a prominent belly. When I went up the stairs on Lundegarten, I only saw him from behind, but he turned around when he clobbered me. I seem to remember that he had a thin face and blue eyes set close together.
"Why didn't you tell me this earlier?" Berger said.
Blomqvist shrugged. "There was a weekend in between, and you went to Göteborg to take part in that damned debate program. You were gone Monday, and on Tuesday we only saw each other briefly. It didn't seem so important."
"But considering what has happened in Enschede, it's odd that you didn't mention this to the police,"
Bublansky said. "Why would I mention it to the police? That's like saying I should have mentioned that I caught a pickpocket trying to rob me in the Tunnelbahn at a tea centrale in a month ago. There is absolutely no imaginable connection between what happened on Lundegarten and what happened in Enschede."
"But you didn't report the attack to the police?"
"No." Blomqvist paused. Lisbeth Salander is a very private person. I considered going to the police, but decided it was up to her to do that if she wanted to. And I wanted to speak to her first.
Which you haven't done?
I haven't spoken to her since the day after Christmas a year ago.
Why did your, if relationship is the right word, why did it end?
Blomqvist's eyes darkened. I don't know. She broke off contact with me. It happened practically overnight.
Did something happen between you?
No. Not if you mean an argument or anything like that. One day we were good friends, the next day she didn't answer her telephone. Then she melted into thin air and was gone from my life. Poblansky contemplated Blomqvist's explanation. It sounded honest, and was supported by the fact that Armansky had described her disappearance from Milton Security in similar terms. Something had apparently happened to Salander during the winter a year earlier. He turned to Berger.
Do you know Salander, too?
I met her once. Could you tell us why you're asking questions about her in connection with Enschede? She said. Poblansky shook his head.
She has been linked to the crime scene. That's all I can say. But I have to admit that the more I hear about Lisbeth Salander, the more surprised I am. What is she like as a person?
In what respect? Blomqvist said.
How would you describe her?
Professionally, one of the best fact-finders I have ever come across. Berger glanced at Blomqvist and bit her lower lip. Poblansky was convinced that some piece of the puzzle was missing, and that they knew something they were unwilling to tell him.
And privately?
Blomqvist paused for a long moment before he spoke. She is a very lonely and odd person, Blomqvist said. Socially introverted. Doesn't like talking about herself. At the same time, she's a person with a strong will. She has morals.
Morals?
Yes. Her own particular moral standards. You can't talk her into doing anything against her will. In her world, things are either right or wrong, so to speak. Again, Blomqvist had described her in the same terms as Armansky had. Two men who knew her, and the same evaluation.
Do you know Dragan Armansky?
We've met a few times. I took him out for a beer once last year when I was trying to find out where Lisbeth had got to.
And you say that she was a competent researcher?
The best, Blomqvist said. Poblansky drummed his fingers on the table and looked down at the flow of people on Gurtgarten. He felt strangely torn. The psychiatric reports that Faster had retrieved from the guardianship agency claimed that Salander was a deeply disturbed and possibly violent person who was for all intents and purposes mentally handicapped. What Armansky and Blomqvist had told him painted a very different picture from the one established by medical experts over several years of study. Both men conceded that Salander was an odd person, but both held her in high regard professionally. Blomqvist had also said that he had been seeing her for a period, which indicated a sexual relationship. Poblansky wondered what rules applied for individuals who had been declared incompetent. Could Blomqvist have implicated himself in some form of abuse by exploiting a person in a position of dependency?
"And how did you perceive her social handicap?"
he asked. "What handicap?"
"The guardianship and her psychiatric problems."
"Guardianship?" "What psychiatric problems?" Berger said. Poblansky looked in astonishment from Blomqvist to Berger and back. They didn't know. They really did not know. Poblansky was suddenly angry at both Armansky and Blomqvist, and especially at Berger, with her elegant clothes and her fashionable office looking down on Gurtgarten.
Here she sits, telling people what to think.
But he directed his annoyance at Blomqvist.
"I don't understand what's wrong with you and Armansky," he said.
"What the hell does that mean?"
"Lisbeth Salander has been in and out of psychiatric units since she was a teenager. A psychiatric assessment and a judgment in the district court determined that she was, and still is, unable to look after her own affairs. She was declared incompetent. She has a documented violent tendency and has been in trouble with the authorities all her life, and now she is a prime suspect in a murder investigation. But you and Armansky talk about her as though she were some sort of princess."
Blomqvist sat motionless,
staring at Bublansky.
"I'll put it another way," Bublansky said. "We were looking for a connection between Salander and the couple in Enschede. It turns out that you not only discovered the victims, you are also the connection. Do you have anything to say to this?"
Blomqvist leaned back, closed his eyes, and tried to make heads or tails of the situation. Salander suspected of murdering Svensson and Johansson. That can't be right. It doesn't make sense. Was she capable of murder? Blomqvist suddenly saw in his mind's eye her expression from 2 years ago when she had gone after Martin Wanger with a golf club. There was no shadow of doubt that she could have killed him. But she didn't, because she had to save my life. He unconsciously reached for his neck where Wanger's noose had been. But Svensson and Johansson? It doesn't make any logical sense whatsoever. He was aware that Bublansky was watching him closely. Like Armansky, Blomqvist had to make a choice. Sooner or later he would have to decide which corner of the ring he was going to be in if Salander was accused of murder. Guilty or not guilty? Before he managed to say anything, the telephone on Vega's desk rang. She picked it up, listened, then handed the receiver to Bublansky. "Somebody called Faste wants to speak to you." Bublansky took the receiver and listened attentively. Blomqvist and Berger could see his expression change.
"When are they going in?"
Silence.
"What's the address again?"
"Lundegarten. And the number?"
"Okay. I'm in the vicinity. I'll drive there."
Bublansky stood up.
"Excuse me, but I'll have to cut this conversation short. Salander's guardian has just been found shot dead. She's now being formally charged in absentia with 3 murders.
Berger's mouth dropped open. Blomqvist looked as if he had been struck by lightning. The occupation of the apartment on Lundegarten was an uncomplicated procedure from a tactical perspective. Faste and Anderson leaned on the hood of their car keeping watch, while the armed response team, supplied with backup weapons, occupied the stairwell and took control of the building and the rear courtyard. The team swiftly confirmed what Faste and Anderson already knew. No one opened the door when they rang the bell. Faste looked down Lundegarten, which was blocked off from Zinkensdamm to Högelid Church, to the great annoyance of the passengers on number 66 bus. One bus had been stuck inside the barriers on the hill and could not go forward or back. Eventually Faste went over and ordered a patrolman to step aside and let the bus through. A large number of onlookers were watching the commotion from upper Lundegarten.
"There has to be a simpler way," Faste said.
"Simpler than what?" Anderson said.
"Simpler than sending in the stormtroopers every time a stray hooligan has to be brought in."
Anderson refrained from commenting.
"After all, she's less than 5 feet tall and weighs about 90 pounds.
It had been decided that it was not necessary to break down the door with a sledgehammer. Bublansky joined them as they waited for a locksmith to drill out the lock, and then he stepped aside so that the troops could enter the apartment. It took about 8 seconds to eyeball the 500 square feet and confirm that Salander was not hiding under the bed, in the bathroom, or in a wardrobe. Then Bublansky was given the all-clear to come in. The 3 detectives looked with curiosity around the impeccably kept and tastefully furnished apartment. The furniture was simple. The kitchen chairs were painted in different pastel colours. There were attractive black-and-white photographs in frames on the walls. In the hall was a shelf with a CD player and a large collection of CDs, everything from hard rock to opera. It all looked arty, elegant, tasteful. Anderson inspected the kitchen and found nothing out of the ordinary. He looked through a stack of newspapers and checked the countertop, the cupboards, and the freezer in the refrigerator. Faste opened the wardrobes and the drawers of the chest in the bedroom. He whistled when he found handcuffs and a number of sex toys. In the wardrobe he found some latex clothing that his mother would have been embarrassed even to look at.
"There's been a party here,"
he said out loud, holding up a patent leather outfit that, according to the label, was designed by Domino Fashion, whatever that was. Bublansky looked in the desk in the hall, where he found a small pile of unopened letters addressed to Salander. He looked through the pile and saw that they were bills and bank statements, and one personal letter. It was from Mikael Blomqvist. So far, Blomqvist's story held up. Then he bent down and picked up the mail on the doormat, stained with footprints from the armed response team. It consisted of a magazine, Thai Pro Boxing, the free newspaper Sudamal News, and three envelopes addressed to Miriam Wu. Oblansky was struck by an unpleasant suspicion.